The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, September 14th, 2018. 3 weeks ago, President Trump was praising Paul Manafort for refusing to break and flip and cooperate with the special prosecutor. Today, Paul Manafort broke and flipped and pled guilty and is cooperating with the special prosecutor. It's a big day for Bob Mueller, but we don't know how big it is, so we thought we'd chew it over with the gang. Joining me in the new Jungle Studio is Lawfare's managing editor, Quinta Jurassic, Paul Rosenzweig, and Bob Bauer. Guys, welcome. Quinta, get us started. What happened today, and what new did we learn factually from this pile of documents that got filed in district court in Washington?
Right. So Manafort pleaded guilty today to two charges that the special counsel filed against him in D.C. District Court, specifically conspiracy against the United States relating to a whole lot of bank and tax fraud that he committed, and also conspiracy to obstruct justice related to efforts by him and his associate Konstantin Kilimnik that they appear to have been trying to dissuade other people from talking to the government about Manafort's lobbying activities, which he did not register for under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. We've had a whole series of Manafort indictments and now a criminal information and statement of offense, especially since there's both the DC trial and recently the trial in the Eastern District of Virginia, where Manafort was convicted of most of the counts against him and the jury deadlocked on the others. The new information in these court documents, it doesn't have much new about the tax and bank fraud of which Manafort is accused and to which he's now pleaded guilty. Rather, that's still in there, but the information is mostly stuff we already had. The new information is mostly about his lobbying work, specifically about his work with something that he apparently referred to as the Habsburg Group of former high-level European officials, including some heads of state, who he worked with to lobby on behalf of Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. And as well as his work with what's identified as Law Firm A, but which we know to be Skadden, which worked to put together a report basically on the trial of Yanukovych's political rival, Yulia Tymoshenko. So there's a lot more detail in here about specifically, you know, what kind of dirty tricks Manafort got up to, exactly what he was doing that he should have registered for and didn't.
By and large, is it fair to say that the Manafort plea essentially validates everything that the special counsel has alleged about him? Or is there some large new set of information that is released in the context of the plea deal?
I think that it's correct. It's correct to say that it basically validates everything that the special counsel has previously alleged. The new information here is really in the realm of sort of filling out details, that kind of thing. But it doesn't significantly change the picture that Mueller has drawn. And a lot of it is essentially corroborating previous reporting by news organizations.
So, Paul, why now? I mean, is this just an eve of trial kind of thing that, you know, the pressure is finally on? Or is there some other reason to think Manafort chose this particular reason to buckle?
Well, it's clearly the start of the trial, which was going to begin next week, was an action-forcing event for both sides. In reality, it's probably more of an action-forcing event for Mueller than it is for Manafort, which is to say that a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, right? Mueller now has a conviction on two very substantive counts and a confirmation in open court by Manafort that the allegations are truthful. That's something that, as we saw in the trial in the Eastern District of Virginia, even with a perfect case going in, you always run the risk of an odd juror holding out on one or more of the counts.
So,
or an odd judge like Ellis, though he wasn't facing that here, but and he might not have faced an odd juror either. So this is for Mueller, leaving aside the clear benefit of the cooperation, which I'm sure we'll talk about, just getting the trial off of his plate and getting a conviction is a good thing. For Manafort, that portion of it is less clear. I mean, he does avoid the expense of a trial, and, you know, 3 weeks in court costs you a lot of money these days, money that he apparently doesn't have. So that's a benefit. And he does manage to kind of link this to his Eastern District of Virginia trial so that the penalty phase will kind of subsume the two together and probably result in a reduction in his sentence, even before we get to the idea of cooperation. So the why now? Because Monday was the day that they were calling the jury.
All right. But there was another day that they were calling the jury, and that was in the Eastern District of Virginia a number of weeks ago, and he blew through that one. And if you were going to maximize your leverage as Paul Manafort and cut the deal at the moment where you had the most leverage, it would have been before, not just before that, but before, your former deputy pled before you, right? And so the question, my question is there any analysis of Manafort's behavior here to go through one trial, nearly go, you know, wait till the eve of trial on the second trial and then cut a deal? Or is the best explanation for Manafort's behavior some kind of self-delusion or other irrational action?
I would offer two explanations. The first is and most likely is that lots of defendants believe in the magic of their own words, their own conduct. They've skated for 15 years on whatever it is, and they expect to work their magic again. I was involved in one case involving, you know, 18 eyewitnesses and a defendant who insisted on going to trial because he thought he could convince the jury that they were all wrong. So there's a sense in which people are irrational facing criminality, and the reality of conviction post the Virginia case might very well have been the straw that kind of broke Manafort's belief in his own magical existence. The other part of it is that I have thought all along that his play was for a pardon from President Trump. And the plea today is inconsistent with that play. So either he, for whatever reason, if that was his plan, he came to believe that he wouldn't get it or that it was less likely that he would get it. Why? I don't know. But that's my best guess, is that he now no longer believes in the pardon, so he feels like he has to make his own best case for himself and his family.
Bob, Sarah Huckabee Sanders today, I forget the exact quote, but she said this has absolutely nothing to do with the president or with the Trump campaign. So obviously that's a bit silly. But it isn't unlike the Michael Cohen plea. It is not a plea that implicates the president or the campaign in criminal wrongdoing in any direct sense. So if you were White House counsel today, what is the right posture for the White House to adopt toward this? Presumably it's not praising Manafort for refusing to break, or now denouncing him for breaking, or saying this has nothing to do with us. What should the White House be saying and doing at this point?
My view has always been, not shared by the current senior staff of the White House, really not shared by the president, that saying very little is their best approach. I don't see any gain whatsoever in their now shifting to an aggressive attack on Manafort while previously commending him for his civic courage and resisting cooperation with a criminal investigation. So I really don't know what to say, except that I couldn't imagine what more detailed or substantive commentary would serve the White House's purposes. I did want to add, because I agree with Paul, that it seemed for some time that Manafort's play, setting aside self-delusion, was for the possibility of a pardon, that it may be he observes, as Cohen before him may have observed, that the president's position is really deteriorating rapidly and that people are beginning to break from him. People that he at one point were thought, after all, Cohen was thought to be the most stalwart of the president's close associates, who prided himself on his unwillingness to ever, ever break with the boss. And I can't help wondering, when Paul says he thinks he wasn't going to get a pardon, whether he's come to the conclusion that betting on the president's loyalty, betting on his steadfastness, his clarity of thought about this, any commitments he may have made, illicitly, implicitly, however, was a bad bet for him.
There's one other factor, and I hesitate to mention it, but after the Skirpal poisoning in the UK, I think that part of what may have motivated Manafort, and this is complete speculation on my part, was a bit of fear. And perhaps he received assurances of some form that would ameliorate that fear. That's totally speculative on my part.
So speculate further. What would such assurances look like?
We'll put you into protective custody. We'll make sure that you serve your sentence in a place where we keep all of the Russians away from you, and when you get out, if you get out after cooperation, we'll help you find a place that is safe and secure. I'm wildly speculative at this point, but there is a decent reason to think that Manafort's experience with the Russians might have left him with an understanding of how they treat people who diverge from the team viewpoint.
Let's talk about the cooperation agreement. So at the time that the plea agreement was disclosed in the press, it was unclear whether there was a cooperation component or whether it was simply pleading out. The plea agreement comes out this afternoon, and in fact, there is a cooperation component. As I read it, it is mostly boilerplate. But it has some interesting elements that, through the boilerplate, are evocative. So I'm going to throw some of them out there and see what y'all think. Number one, it is clear that there has been a proffer. And that means that the language in it, which is standard language, that we won't prosecute you for anything heretofore disclosed, has an element of threat, right? If you didn't proffer it and we find out about it, we reserve the right to come down on you like a ton of bricks. Number two, the guideline range, at least as I read the plea agreement, for Manafort is monstrous. It's 210 to 262 months. So if you're 69 years old, which he is, you're looking at 17 and a half years, and the only basis in that agreement for a downward departure is a prosecutor 5K1 substantial assistance motion. So if I'm Paul Manafort and I'm signing that document, I know that the only way I'm going to see the light of day again from prison, other than through a prison yard, is if I have something substantial enough to say that I get that 5K1 departure motion. And so let me throw out two hypotheses and curious what you all make of it. One is that's just because they had him dead to rights and he didn't plead out early and he lost all his what Trump would call leverage. And, you know, this was he had no bargaining power left. And so, you know, it was that or get something worse after a jury verdict. Option number two, the proffer was good and he's relying on the fact that he actually has something substantial to say and that he's going to impress. It is going to be of value enough to bring that down to a level that he's going to, you know, be able to spend some time with his grandkids again. Quinta, what's your hypothesis? When you look at this story, does this look like Manafort has a story to tell and Mueller wants it? Or is it just Manafort's clock ran out and he's going to spend a lot of time in prison one way or the other?
Well, I have to say, I have completely given up predicting the future, much less specifically what's going to happen in the Mueller investigation. There is definitely the universe of things that one could reasonably imagine Manafort knows about relating to this investigation is pretty big, especially because he was present at the notorious Trump Tower meeting with Don Jr. And that's particularly interesting because many people, including Don Jr., have now said that the president himself have had no knowledge of the meeting before or afterward. So, you know, if it turns out that Manafort has a story to tell there, that could be pretty big. On the other hand, you know, I don't want to compare Manafort, who was the campaign manager, to George Papadopoulos, the coffee boy. But it is true that recently with the Papadopoulos sentencing, it kind of turned out that someone who, at least I will say I thought, and I think, Ben, you thought, was key to the investigation, turned out to really not have offered very much at all. Not saying that the same thing is going to happen here, but that is a good reminder that we might want to remain humble in what we can derive from this.
Yeah, really good point. I mean, I just speaking personally, I was convinced that that the 3-month lag between when Papadopoulos was stopped by the FBI at Dulles Airport and when his name showed up in court papers in October of last year, I was convinced that that reflected a period of active cooperation on his part. And I was real surprised to find out that actually he provided, according to Mueller's team, no substantial assistance at all. And so I do think that's a very wise caution. That said, speculate, guys. What, Paul? What do you think? Are we looking at does Manafort hold the keys to the kingdom?
I don't think there's any worst case for Manafort, right? 17 years makes him 86. He's dead. So, you know, if you give him 25 years, he's still dead in prison. Either way, so for him, the only option is getting out. The only thing he saved by not going to trial is the expense of going to trial. But since he's probably not going to pay his bills, because all of his money is seized, right? So the only person who really got a real benefit out of this was his attorneys, who didn't have to give 3 weeks of time to the judge. That would be in the end uncompensated. So with that having been said, it strikes me as more likely than not that at least some of what Manafort is doing is trying to make a play for freedom. And that means that he at least thinks it's possible that he can provide some testimony that is of substantial assistance to the government.
What do you think, Bob? I know this is rank speculation, but what's your rank speculation?
Cohen's plea brought the case to Trump for the first time in the sense that the president was at that point exposed to reasonable concerns about his legal exposure. In other words, he had something to say about the president that led people to think, yes, it's not simply that his lieutenants have run into all sorts of trouble. He may have trouble of his own. This flip, if you will, I mean, the decision on the part of Manafort to cooperate brings the collusion case, the Russia piece of this, potentially right to the president. Now, obviously we're speculating. We don't know what he will say and whether it'll be very significant or less than significant. I have no reason to doubt Paul's view that certainly Manafort is making a play and he thinks it'll be meaningful and will have some effect in discounting the time he has to serve in prison. But as Quinta mentioned, he has the ability to fairly decisively address, well, decisively may be strong, but add significant testimony to the Trump Tower meeting, what the president knew in advance, what actually happened at the meeting, what the expectation was, what the follow-up was, whether the president directed any follow-up, whether the president was in an ongoing conversation with them about how to extract even better information from the Russians than apparently they received at that meeting. We have Manafort also involved, but so far nothing to link the president to, the changes that he engineered in the Republican platform, in the Ukrainian provision, the provision having to do with Ukraine. We have the relationship that he was maintaining at that time with Russia right there during the campaign, including this set of briefings he was promising to Oleg Deripaska and, you know, what all of that meant or how in any way it reflected on the campaign. So I find this is a witness, unlike Papadopoulos, who, after all, Quinta referred to him as a coffee boy, is not a senior member of the campaign team and was quite obscure at the time his name first popped up in the press. Manafort is a significant witness to various aspects of the issue that is central to the Mueller investigation. And so he is, as a flip, again, we know the Cohn has suggested he knows something about the 2016 Trump Tower meeting, and that's been disputed as well as confirmed by his own lawyer in an interesting kind of play.
Another example of the finest quality lawyering that we have seen in L'Affaire Russe.
So Cohn's position on this seems to be a little bit ambiguous, but it's not ambiguous that Manafort was present and that Manafort has something to say about this, and it's not hearsay. So I think it's a potentially significant development in the case, absolutely.
So all of this reminds me of another cautionary note. It's not the Papadopoulos cautionary note, but it's the Webb-Hubble cautionary note. Back in the Clinton investigation, which I participated in, Webb-Hubble pled guilty.
Wait, back up, because, you know, a substantial number of our listeners are not actually old enough to know who Webb-Hubble is.
Jesus, he's burned in my brain.
Yeah, me too.
So Webster Hubble was a law partner of Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm, B, a close personal friend of Bill Clinton, and C, later the number three lawyer in the Department of Justice, the Associate Attorney General. He was, as Bob characterized Manafort, kind of there at the creation, somebody who would have known something about almost all of the things that were swirling around the Clintons, ranging from their Whitewater investments that involved the Rose Law Firm to the alleged cover-up of by shutting down the Treasury investigation at the Resolution Trust Corporation when he was Attorney General. So he had, if he had it, he had the keys to this kingdom. And on the basis of an expectation that he would give those keys to the independent counsel, he was given a plea deal with a promise of cooperation, and then his cooperation amounted to, so I don't know nothing about none of that, sir. And he stood on that for the rest of his time. And so the independent counsel had, in effect, bought a pig in the poke and was, I think it's fair to say, disappointed in the degree of Mr. Hubble's cooperation. So I don't know, maybe Mr. Manafort is the Webb-Hubble of this investigation.
Although if I were Bob Mueller, and after everything I had been through with Paul Manafort, I don't think I would cut this deal on faith.
The Star people didn't do it on faith either. They thought they had more.
No, but there was, I mean, it seems to me one of two possibilities here. Either there is a proffer that has satisfied them, in which they think they know what they are getting in some granularity, or as you proffered at the beginning, they have made the judgment, hey, this is a good deal for us, even if we don't get any information, because we wanted to put this guy away for a while, and we're going to put him away for a while.
A win is a win,
and we can do it without a trial. But I doubt very much that there's a pig in the poke quality to this, where they think that they're getting the keys to the kingdom from Paul Manafort, and they're in fact going to get a whole lot of shrugs. Is that naive of me?
Well, without revisiting the Starr investigation too much, the lead prosecutor who worked the deal with Hubble was a former U.S. attorney, one of the most highly regarded prosecutors of public corruption in the United States at the time, and he seems to have misunderstood or miscalculated. So prosecutors make mistakes, even great ones like Robert Mueller. I suspect strongly that it's more along the lines of what you said, that it's either, hey, it's better than nothing, a win is a win is a win, or we've got a good proffer and not an error. But, we should bear in mind that error is not unique to the Trump campaign side of the equation.
The other distinction I might draw between Hubble and Manafort is Hubble, as I recall, was convicted or he pled on billing fraud issues. Mm-hmm. He had, as Associate Attorney General, some exposure to President Clinton's activities, and he knew presumably what Hillary Clinton was doing at the Rose Law Firm. But Manafort, unlike Hubble, is a very central figure. So he's a really central figure in a way that I don't think Hubble really was. And B, and not to put too fine a point on it, somebody who seems to have trailed legal violations everywhere he went. So in other words, it may be that they bounced into Hubble's billing practices and were surprised to find out about it, but there wasn't more that he was involved in that was disreputable. But it certainly seems that Paul Manafort is somebody whose carelessness, recklessness, knowingness in legal matters suggests to me, together with his centrality, that he could be an explosive witness. And I'm not saying that because, I'm trying to push the narrative in that direction, but I just want to say I think Manafort occupies a distinctly more significant sphere in this investigation than Hubble might have in the Starr investigation.
So I tend to agree with that, but I also think the analogy between the two is in some ways relatively precise. So yes, there is no Oleg Deripaska or Viktor Yanukovych figure at the Rose Law Firm or, in Arkansas. But these are both people who, and Paul, please correct me if I get any of the Whitewater details here wrong, but these are both people who who had flamboyant collateral criminality to the matter that the special counsel, or in that case, the independent counsel, was investigating, who, in one case, Bob Fisk and then Ken Starr, and in this case, Bob Mueller, had dead to rights on this other stuff, and who they believed might have, or may have believed, might have the keys to a kingdom that is not directly implicated by the criminality that they were associated with. And so I've often thought of, now the difference is that, billing fraud with Arkansas law firm bills is a little bit different from, $70 million in international money laundering with foreign heads of state. And so there's, as with all things Trump versus Clinton, there's kind of there's type analogy that work and scale and malevolence analogy that doesn't work. Quinta, jump in.
Yeah, I mean, first off, I'm not going to speak to anything about Webb Hubble because I was in kindergarten at that point. But I do think what this stuff with Manafort points to is that there's so many things in the Russia investigation where it's something that initially, or I don't even know if it initially seemed like this, but perhaps it was possible at the beginning that there might have been a pretty clean story to tell, collusion or no collusion. And what's happened as we've gotten deeper and deeper into it is just that there's this kind of fractal of criminal activity, frankly, that you see with Manafort that, there's an enormous amount of stuff with Flynn that the press got into that the special counsel didn't actually put into court documents. There's and with Alex Vanderswan, who was sentenced in recent months, who worked on the Skadden report on Timoshenko, that, you know, could have been something that was very significant, seems to not just be a kind of weird dead end. That this story is so layered and complicated and almost unintelligible at the moment that I think my hesitancy to say, you know, maybe Manafort really does have, you know, the answers here, is that the whole mess has just been so resistant to answers thus far.
Okay, so that's a great basis on which to zoom out, right? And to say, like, all right, where are we now? On the one hand, Mueller has an increasingly impressive record of bringing cases, when forced to justify those cases, justifying those cases, and garnering pleas, when forced to go to trial, getting convictions. On the other hand, as Quinta points out, not a lot of answers so far on the fundamental questions, presidential, collusion, to the extent that that's even a question, right, what it means, and also presidential obstruction of justice.
So I want to push back a little bit on Quinta's characterization that we really haven't learned anything and that this is too complex. That may be true if your focus is exclusively on the nature of President Trump's relationship to the allegations of Russian interference. But it isn't true, it affirmatively isn't true, if you broaden the lens a bit and you ask whether or not we know more now about what Russia did in the 2016 elections than we did before Mr. Mueller started his investigation. Before he started the investigation, about the only thing we had was the IC's conclusion, which was a conclusion without backup evidence that there was that they were convinced that there was interference. Now, if you look at the indictment of the Internet Research Agency and all of the people involved with it, we have a painfully clear exposition of the ways in which Russia manipulated the social media environment in an attempt to influence the election. And if you look at Mueller's indictment of the 12 GRU operatives, military operatives, we have an equally clear exposition of how they hacked into the DNC, hacked into the DCCC, hacked into Hillary Clinton's campaign, and took information of that and essentially weaponized it, both through release via WikiLeaks and also through release via fake persona, DCist and Guccifer 2.0, who were not real people, but were the Russians pretending to be real people. So we've gone from a place where we had nothing more than the bald assertion of the IC, which frankly I trusted, but others might not, to a place where the forensic information and evidence is sufficiently great that there can be no doubt, none whatsoever in anybody's mind, except possibly that of our president, that Russia systematically interfered with our investigation. I think that if we commissioned a 9/11 type commission to examine Russian interference in the election and task them with writing a final report, their report would look very much like these indictments.
Okay, so one follow-up on that. So if Bob Mueller issues a statement tomorrow saying, got nothing useful from Paul Manafort, don't have enough to proceed against anybody else, shutting down, got nothing more to say, goodbye, you think Bob Mueller investigation already a success?
Indeed. I mean, I'd personally be a little disappointed in that result, but notwithstanding, it would be his speaking indictments are in effect his final report to the U.S. public about what he thinks has happened. And that's a good thing. Whether or not we have the good sense as a society to act on them, that's another question.
Points. First of all, his job is to conduct this investigation in a professional and credible fashion. Let's set aside the president's ceaseless attacks on him. But to conduct the investigations in a creditable, professional fashion, consistent with the highest standards, and to go where the facts lead him. And I agree with Paul that the outcome should be judged by those criteria and not by any other expectations about what the substantive outcome might be. So if he concludes, for example, that he doesn't have enough on which to bring indictments for obstruction of justice in the Comey firing, in connection with that and other potential issues of obstruction, then so be it. But how he goes about this and the quality of what he produces when he does proceed, as you suggested with the Russian parties, I think is going to wind up being very much to his credit. Now, one more point about Manafort. And again, not because I want to drive the narrative into a particular direction. I will contest your suggestion that Manafort's criminality, as you put it, I think you said something to the effect his criminality was collateral to the matters that are directly under review here or of direct, most immediate interest, again, speaking of obstruction and of collusion. And I disagree with that. I think that Manafort is a crucial witness. We know, for example, that one of his aides was identified as a potential ongoing active Russian intelligence agent. He was having, while campaign manager of the campaign, active communications with the Russians. Where that goes, what it tells us about collusion per se, as people generally understand it, is still not to be known. But his involvement with Russia, his potential trafficking with the Russians around campaign-related matters, at a minimum, he was promising special briefings to Russians about what was taking place during the campaign. We don't know more about that. We certainly know that he attended that Trump Tower meeting. He was the most senior person in the room. Is it conceivable he didn't tell his boss, the candidate, that the meeting had been proposed, what happened at the meeting, whether there was going to be any follow-up to the meeting? Maybe. What are the chances? Less than 15%. Now, when we find out what actually happened,
I like
15%. For some reason, it always comes to mind, right? When I try to decide what's inadequate, I think 15, less than 15 would do the job. So I really think that he's a critical witness here. And again, the other possibility, since he is singing for his supper or angling for his freedom, is that there may be some question of whether what he offers up in the plea agreement will survive testing, right? So he may say all sorts of things, and it may not be enough to go on for the prosecutor. So we ought to keep that in mind. The jury didn't think very highly of his associate Gates, apparently. And there does come a point where the credibility of somebody like that on pure say-so is a real open question. But I think he's a critical witness. I think this moment brings us much, much closer to the conclusion of this investigation on those two central issues than we've been up to this point.
I want to talk about pardons. Paul raised the issue earlier. Manafort appears to have been playing for a pardon or may have been playing for a pardon. That moment, he seems to have lost faith. My question is a reciprocal one about the president, which is, has the moment at which if you decided I'm going to blow up this investigation by pardoning Paul Manafort, is that moment past? Because now he's already proffered. Yeah, you could reduce all of Mueller's leverage against him, you know, on sentencing stuff. If you pardoned him, you could make it a lot easier for him to lie. But basically, over the last few days and the next few days, Mueller's going to know what Paul Manafort knows. So if you're going to obstruct this investigation, I don't mean that within the meaning of the obstruction statute, but if you're going to screw up this investigation by pardoning Paul Manafort, did the president miss the window to do it?
I think so. He can still try and retrieve it. A pardon today would, if this moment, a pardon this moment would relieve Manafort of any threat of further imprisonment, would result in his immediate release from prison. I don't actually know offhand what it does to the forfeiture provisions, but because I
president can remit fines. Right?
Yeah. So I imagine he gets most of his money back. But to be clear, I don't know that because I've never actually thought of it until this very second. So you know, there's a value to Manafort telling Mueller stuff, but there's more value to Manafort being available to tell juries that same thing. And by pardoning Manafort, Trump could at least cut his losses and reduce his downside. But I think your instinct is right, that it's very difficult to unring this bell, to put the toothpaste back in the toothpaste tube. You got all the metaphors. So I would think he sort of blew it.
What do you think, Bob? If you were advising a malevolent president how to be the most malevolent president he could, consistent with his Article II powers, and he said to you, I've got this awesome pardon power, and I want to use it to screw up the investigation, Would you advise him do it before the guy pleas, or would you advise him do it after the guy pleas?
I probably, after, you know, 30 minutes of reflection and 10 seconds of research, would conclude that he probably should have done it earlier. My own sense of it is that at this point, if he were to wander across my path and say, "What do you think? Is this the moment?" And I'd be interested in Paul's view on this. Maybe I'm wrong at this hour, but for him to issue a pardon right now after it's been announced that Manafort's about to cooperate with the prosecution, I do not think is going to be helpful to him, whatever his overall standing is right now with the prosecutors on obstruction. It's one thing to take a principled position. This Manafort is a victim. He's under fire. It's a terrible thing. Then Manafort pleads guilty and says, "Now I'm about ready to talk." And the president steps in and says, "I pardon you. Don't worry about talking."
It's funny you mention that, because Paul just today wrote an op-ed saying this with Justin Florence. So, Paul, tell us about your op-ed.
Well, I mean, the point of the op-ed, which is responsive to Bob's question, is that I think that a president's pardon power is cabined by other applicable laws and constitutional provisions. Which isn't to say that the pardon wouldn't be effective. I think it probably would get Manafort out of jail. But I do not think that a president can exercise his pardon power in a way intended to obstruct justice. The test case that we wrote about in the op-ed was, imagine Jimmy Carter very famously pardoned everybody who had violated the law in resistance to the Vietnam War, right? Which was, whatever you think of it, was a nice, graceful gesture. What if he'd only pardoned white people? Right? Or only the Catholics and not the Jews and the Protestants and the Muslims. You have to think that there are boundaries beyond which a president's exercise of this illimitable power trench upon other laws and constitutional provisions. And I would think that with you, that a pardon of Manafort to stop him from cooperating, precisely because it's to stop him from cooperating, would be seen as another arrow in the quiver of obstruction of justice.
And to be clear, are you saying that it would be a violation of the obstruction of justice statute, or are you saying it would be an impeachable offense?
I think it would be both. I think it would be not obstruction, but probably witness tampering, which is the more narrow specification of the obstruction charges. It would be offering something in exchange for trying to get somebody not to testify truthfully. But it would also be clearly impeachable.
So if I may, I completely agree with the legal conclusion that Paul just articulated. I certainly think it would be an impeachable offense, which is a different story, of course, but has overlapping points of contact with the legal conclusion, but I think it's a different story. I cannot resist asking the following hypothetical question. What if a lawyer in Mueller's office goes to Mueller and says, "Okay, we're about to strike this deal, but what if the president tries to do that? Can we condition the deal on Manafort's agreement that he will not accept a pardon if the president issues it?"
I think the answer to that is easy.
Yeah, actually. There's a Supreme Court case says that pardons must be accepted.
And a plea agreement is simply a contract between the government and a defendant party.
No question. Because I think it's a Wilson administration court ruling, as I recall, that a pardon can be rejected or declined. But my question is, let's assume that the president says, "I'm going to pardon," and he'd previously committed that he wouldn't accept the pardon. And then all of a sudden he thinks, "Well, you know, on second thought, I'll accept the pardon." Can you enforce an agreement not to accept a presidential pardon?
We have so much fun in this.
I actually think there's an answer to this question that's embedded in every plea agreement, which is that every plea agreement contains a provision promising to waive appeal rights, and those are enforceable. And so I think to the extent that, you know, he would have to go into court and plead the pardon, if he goes to the D.C. Circuit and he tries to appeal his conviction, you can say he waived appellate rights in this agreement. Just as you could do that, I don't see why you couldn't say, in pursuant to this plea agreement, he waived the right to plead this pardon.
So I would say I think that's right. I'm not sure if I'm 100% clear on the law here, but I believe so. Burdick v. United States, which is the case about rejecting a pardon in 1915, I believe one of the holdings was that the pardoned individual has to introduce the pardon into court proceedings; otherwise, it may be disregarded by the court. So the court has no obligation to stand by a pardon if you don't introduce it into proceedings, which I assume means that you know, if he decided not to have those proceedings, if he agreed not to put those proceedings in motion, that the court wouldn't have to consider it.
So why is it any different from in the plea agreement? He agrees to waive trial by jury, waive appeals rights?
Because the only remedy for a breach of the agreement is to rescind it and put the government back in the position it was before, where it would be able to indict him for these offenses for which he's now been pardoned. I would add, however, that there is at least some strain of law that I believe would support the argument that a pardon procured through criminal means is no pardon, and that the court might choose not to accept the pardon. Now, that's extreme, and I'm not sure I agree with it. But, for example, if I paid the president a bribe of $1 million to pardon me for the offense of, money laundering, and then I were indicted on money laundering, and even if I accepted that pardon and put it into evidence, there's at least some plausibility to the argument that a pardon procured through criminal means is not effective. Okay. I don't know.
So can we agree that this hypothetical, while delightful, is actually beside the point, or all these hypotheticals, while delightful, are beside the point? And the relevant point, let's see if I'm right, is that everybody around the table agrees that if the president pardoned Manafort in an effort to obstruct the investigation, that would unambiguously be an impeachable offense?
Unambiguously.
Unambiguously.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not sure it's a violation of any Title 18 statute. I think that's a complicated question, but I have zero doubt that it's an impeachable offense. And I wonder if that's actually the thing that's restraining Trump on it, that he has this.
He can't possibly be worried about this Congress impeaching.
No, but he's worried
about the next Congress, but this is not that problem.
But I do think he is generically held back by a sense of it as something that the political ramifications of which would be unspeakable.
We're talking about Trump in this hypothetical using a pardon in a very sort of rational game theoretical way. You know, is it wise? What does he get out of pardoning Manafort after Manafort has pleaded guilty? I think that the way he has historically used the pardon power is really as a sort of emotive form of expression.
You could say rage tweeting.
Yeah, it's essentially it's rage tweeting with you know through Article 2. And I think that, you know, he was so big on Manafort, you know, he was brave, he didn't break, yada yada yada, as opposed to Cohen, and we've seen in contrast how he really lashed out at Cohen after Cohen pleaded guilty. And so I would imagine, although I don't think Trump has tweeted about this so far, that he's probably not feeling very warm toward Paul Manafort at the moment, and therefore probably would not want to bestow his mercy upon him, whether or not that would be wise.
I agree with that. I think there are two issues that affect the president's thinking, may be affecting the president's thinking on pardoning. The first is, I think he has been receiving unambiguous signals from the Congress, from Republicans, that they have deep concerns about his abuse of the pardon power. So that's on his side of the aisle. Chuck Grassley said something very tart and aggressive and negative when the president was crowing about the possibility that he could pardon himself. And so he has to be sensitive to that, even if he's not quite ready to buy into the idea that the Democrats are going to regain control of the universe and move against him immediately. The second thing is, I think if we see him pardon anybody, it'll be Don Jr.
On that ominously cheerful note, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare podcast, which of course means we have no outgoing music, which would, if we had it, be performed by Sophia Yan. But thanks this week to Quinta Jurassic, who has been so brave and hasn't broken, and Paul Rosenzweig, who, despite pressure, hasn't flipped and told lies about me, and Bob Bauer, who, you know, who's been, you know, lots of people are flipping under the pressure, but Bob has been, and his wonderful family, they've been like a rock. And also to Michaela Fogel, who's been sitting there in the corner being our audio engineer and hasn't flipped on me either. And we're gonna say that if you have not gone to the iTunes store, the Apple Podcasts, and given a rating to the Lawfare podcast, you better do it right now or we're all gonna flip on you. And tweet us, share us on Facebook, and as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.